Hello and welcome to the Torture Shack Live, and it is an extra special Sunday this week because we have our roving reporter, Dr. Caroline West, is outside the Grave Diggers waiting for Tony Groves to finish his marathon because he is just about finished. Oh, it looks like quite the crowd there. Looks like he is going to do his run 2020. So he has run 2,020 miles so far this year, and being the absolute overachiever that he is, he has completed it 2 months early, and he has done it to raise money for the Anna Liffey Project and for ICHH. So we are waiting for him to come across the finish line, and Caroline will try and catch up with him if he doesn't fall over, because he has done 26.2 miles in about 3 hours this morning, just over 3 hours by the looks of it. So fair play to Tony. So I am Linda Hayden from the Pack Woman podcast, and I am joined this week by Dr. Vicky Conway from Policed in Ireland, by Martin McMahon from the Echo Chamber podcast. As we said, we had Caroline West from Glow West, and she is frantically on the lookout for Tony there. And we are delighted to be joined by Holly Cairns TD for the Social Democrats for Cork, and somebody who really held feet to the flames this week, Holly, in regard to the sealing of the archives of the mother and baby homes. So talk to us a little bit about how the week has been, what has happened. We're all just shocked. I think I haven't seen, apart from the government and government supporters, I haven't seen one positive reaction. Talk to me about what that's been like.
Yeah, so it has been a hard week for so many people. I think it's compounded the trauma and the suffering that a lot of people experienced in Ireland over years. And this bill was brought to the Dáil and the Seanad at a lightning speed. So it was published about 2 weeks ago, and it was rushed through the Houses without pre-legislative scrutiny. You know, throughout this two-week period, we've seen human rights lawyers and experts, and most importantly, survivors, saying this is not what we want. This does not provide justice. And, you know, I think on the whole, it's really important when we talk about this situation and related ones to zoom out and remember the magnitude of what we're talking about. So, like, this commission was formed in light of the discovery of 600 dead babies and young children found in tomb in a misused septic tank. And one of the other homes that the commission was examining was Besborough, where hundreds, like I think it's 600 or 900 babies were disappeared, and they can account for less than 100 of those. So it's very serious. And 35,000 women were incarcerated in these homes. So I just think it's really important to remember that. And I suppose the week went on and a lot of TDs and lawyers and activists and everybody were saying this is simply incompatible with EU law as well, you know, on top of everything else. Of course, the day after this was all passed, the Examiner broke the news that the Data Protection Commission, could confirm that the government went against their advice. So they're essentially breaking the law and passing this bill. And unfortunately, it was passed by the government parties. So that's one law. But I think, you know, there's also so many other laws that are being ignored here. Like, these are the worst kind of human rights violations imaginable. So if you take one, it could be, you know, enforced family separation, enforced disappearance, incarceration, institutional abuse. We're ignoring all of those crimes. Like, these are just, if you imagine any other scenario whereby these crimes are committed, we don't seal away archives and say that we're doing it in the interest of the victims. That's just, you know, why has nobody been held to account on this? Why do they continuously bring in legislation that further silences victims? And it just shows that the state, you know, always treats these things as a scandal to be contained rather than opportunities to do the right thing for survivors, for people who have suffered the worst kind of abuse at the hands of the state, you know.
Do you think about, just in terms of that, sorry to cut across you, I do have a question on it. Do you think that's why? Do you think that's why the breakneck speed to try and get it through and get them sealed? Because there is people still alive that could be held accountable for this. Do you think it's a case that it's to placate people who are implicated in these crimes, or like, what's the reasoning behind it? I've been trying to figure it out all week, and that's the only thing I can
do. It's really, you know, it's worth analysing why this is happening. And like, historically, and we talk about this historical abuse, it's actually current, because without justice, this abuse is still going on. And I think there's always been a silencing around these issues in Ireland. You know, I remember just growing up, and there was a case of horrific abuse by the religious order in my own parish. You know, the priest that would come into school every day and read from the Bible and stuff. And he was replaced by somebody who's completely the opposite, fairly lively. But my distinct memory of that scenario was just silence. You know, I don't even have any anecdotes about it. All I remember is a huge silence around that issue. And that is how culturally and societally we have dealt with institutional abuse. So that's playing in to every way that we deal with this. It's playing into politics. And we've seen in the past exactly this done. So government is saying things like, no, we'll introduce a broader piece of legislation which will, you know, ensure access for survivors, all this kind of stuff. The files, the archives from the Ryan report, you know, from institutional abuse as well, were sealed over 10 years ago for 75 years. And loads of people have been denied access to their stories, their own personal information, their names, all of these things. And there hasn't been an attempt to rectify that. So to ask survivors to just trust government that they will do that when they have proven time and time again that they don't and they won't is just ridiculous, especially when they rush through this legislation without even consulting with survivors. Why would they put their trust in them? If they were going to bring in that broader piece of legislation, why not, for the avoidance of doubt, put into this one that they
the
will
thing
allow
is as well? I know that Ahantus met with Roderick O'Gorman, and he listened to what they had to say and he ignored it. So what happens next with this? Like, it's going to go to the president. Do you think that the president will do something to maybe stop it? The data commissioner has said that it's illegal. So is there a case then for the EU to step in? Like, what happens next?
What happens next? Yeah, indeed, it goes to the president next. And I think, given that the government are breaking the law, there's obviously, you know, things that need to be taken into consideration in relation to passing this. But I was trying to look into that. What is the situation? Like, presidents don't normally step in the way of legislation. But of course, we know Michael Dee is an amazing human rights activist, and I'm sure he's not comfortable with this. But I think, and I stand to be corrected on this, because, like I said, I'm only looking into it now, that if that does happen, that can get in the way or be kind of a prohibitor to other cases that are being taken against the state in relation to these issues.
Can I come in and explain that?
Please, yes.
With Article 26, it allows the president to take a case straight to the Supreme Court to challenge the constitutionality, not the legality, but just the constitutionality of a bill. And if the Supreme Court, when you do that, says it is constitutional, it can never be challenged again. And one of the issues with the president doing it is he's doing it in the absence of a case. So, and you have to... A scenario could arise that they don't make an argument for during the case, which might justify unconstitutionality, but you don't have it to hand right now. And there's also a point about, like, this isn't a direct, this bill doesn't contravene anyone's privacy. It's not disclosing anything. So the question actually becomes, do you have a constitutional right to accessing your data, which would be a new right? It'd be a new interpretation. And some people are saying that that's inherent the way GDPR is done, that is actually a right that has constitutional status, but that's never actually been determined. So he got two other bills on Friday and he has signed those, and he hasn't signed this bill. So he's clearly thinking about it.
Okay.
Because all week you'd be thinking, what is going on? Why? You know, just even down to the basic, like, at the very least, allow this bill to go through the proper passages of the houses. You know, there's no reason why it could do that. Like, why blatantly rush?
It's Tony. Sorry
to cut across you, Holly. We're going to go to Caroline very quickly. Caroline, can you hear us?
Unmute her.
Unmute. Oh, Martin, can you unmute Caroline? Oh, don't go. Martin, can you unmute Caroline, please? You're on. She's gone.
What's going on?
We can't hear you, Caroline. There we go.
Tony!
Tony! So Tony has just completed his marathon, and how long did it take you?
3:36 and 40 something, right?
Well,
amazing.
And how much money do you know? Hey, and there's Rory
we don't know. We were at $6,500 this morning. I don't know what we've raised, but every cent is brilliant. Thanks so much to everybody for doing that. It really it means the world, and I'm so happy that's over.
Yeah. And so, how are you feeling?
That was a tough one. Yeah. It's not the same, but it's just amazing to see the people all the way along the route. And I fell and nearly crippled myself.
He did, the poor fella fell over completely.
Yeah. Total drama. Listen, guys, go enjoy it. Look, finish off. Thanks so much for everybody, and thanks for all the support. And do put your hands in your pockets, please, please, for a really good cause.
You enjoy that cake.
Yeah, I'll second that. He actually did run it. I'll verify that.
Rory Hearn there, who ran it with him.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well done, guys.
No worries. No, it's an amazing achievement for him. And he's crying there at the end. So, you know, it means a lot to him and it means a lot to everyone. So it really is an impressive achievement. And he actually completely fell at one point along the canal. He tripped over and fell down, did a ninja roll and got back up again. So, yeah, all round hero. As I said, he's the modern day Che Guevara. There's no doubt about it.
we're trying to get we've had it. #Run2020 is trending on Twitter. Send some congratulations messages. It's a huge achievement. 2020 miles in 10 months. Like phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. Well done, and well done to Rory for pacing
miles up. As well, not kilometers, because he didn't realize it was shorter to do kilometers.
Fair play. Right, we will come back to Holly. Apologies for the interruption.
Holly. Important interruption.
So the president's obviously thinking about it. We've had over 100,000 signatures in 36 hours on a repeal the seal petition. So people are obviously still, it has been trending since Wednesday, more or less. So what do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, I think, you know, a movement has started. You know, it reminds me of other kind of social movements we've seen in Ireland followed by referendums. And I think it's one of those situations whereby if you went around and asked every individual Irish person, would they like to see justice for these people? Would they like these situations to be handled in the complete opposite way? The vast majority would say yes. So eventually government will have to listen. So things like, would everybody please sign that petition? Please share it. We need to hold government to account. And I suppose that's the job of TDs as well. You know, Minister O'Gorman has made a lot of promises in terms of creating legislation that will do these things, and we'll be absolutely pushing for that, bringing forward bills, motions, anything we can possibly do. But this isn't over. And the fact that the Data Protection Commission has come out and said that the government actually went against their recommendations, the minister needs to answer questions on this. There are so many unanswered questions in relation to this legislation being passed. You know, I've been thinking about it this weekend, like what happened in the last 2 weeks with Minister Roderick O'Gorman? You know, did, for example, he see that recommendation from the Data Protection Commissioner? Was his department just advising him on how to handle the situation? You know, why was he, you know, we saw the examiner referring to it as him left holding the bag. And to a certain extent, you'd have some sympathy for him, like nobody stood up with him, nobody sat with him in the Dáil. You didn't see the Taoiseach come out. You didn't see the leader of the Green Party coming out. You didn't see anything. But like, what actually happened? How much did he know? How much was he, you know, reading off a script? What is the situation here? Why has this been the result of it? Over and over again, human rights lawyers, TDs and senators were pointing out that this is simply incompatible with EU law. The examiner's gotten an FOI to prove that the minister, or at least his department, knew that. Did government TDs know that? You know, should we have had a vote on that when we didn't have all the relevant information? And what was going on for the minister in that situation? Because at the end of the day, what we do know is that he, no matter what, could have dug his heels in. He is the minister and said no. And, you know, for example, at the very least, I am going to allow this to go through the proper passages of the houses rather than completely unnecessarily rush it through. Because at the very least, what victims deserve in this scenario, or survivors, is respect. And to not consult them, to unnecessarily rush it through, to give out false information about what information the government were given is a national disgrace. You know, I said it in the Dáil, can you think of anything worse than those kind of horrific crimes that were committed systematically? And here's an example of something that almost feels worse, is instead of talking about what we can do to provide justice, can we do the right thing now in this situation? We're actually having a conversation about sealing these archives away for 30 years against their wishes. It is just, the minister needs to come in and answer more questions. We need to know exactly what happened and why, because none of it makes sense.
Can I just say there's 130,000 signatures now on the petition? And if I could just come back to something you said earlier, Holly, in the motivation behind this, it is worth remembering that a lot of the people in government who voted on this were born in and around the same time as those that they are denying the rights. And they were born in and around the same time. So why are they doing this? I don't believe that it's politicians. I believe it's institutionally driven. I believe it's the civil service who are trying to hide their secrets, not the government that exists of the day. These people aren't the same government that was there 40 years ago. So they have no vested interest in covering up, but the civil service does. Absolutely 100% does. And this misuse of GDPR, this is simply a replication of what has gone on before with the misuse of GDPR. So I definitely think there needs to be an inquiry into why the state is deliberately abusing GDPR and who's pushing that agenda. Who is pushing it? Because I don't actually believe it's politicians pushing it.
I agree with you, Tony, definitely. But I also think that politicians have to take responsibility for how they've handled this situation too, because you can't just come out as a puppet and say things that are just incorrect and quite frankly ridiculous. Like, even I raised this on Tuesday morning in the first sitting of the Dáil for the week with the Taoiseach, and I said, you know, you admitted that mistakes were made in relation to the Ryan report, and you have an opportunity to not repeat mistakes of the past today, you know, because the gagging order was introduced after the Ryan report, and that was on the last day of that government before the Dáil was resolved, so it didn't go through any debate at all, and that was just put into law. And like he said in response, I was the person who gave those people their voice. And like, for one, their voice was actually taken away from them. You didn't give them their voice, and you don't give somebody their voice with a gagging order attached to it. It's just, even the word gagging goes against giving voice to somebody. You know, there's, like I said, you'd understand, you'd kind of almost at times feel sorry for Minister Roderick O'Gorman this week and stuff. But at the end of the day, there's also a responsibility on elected representatives to actually just stand up and say no or why, right, or yeah, something. You know, and because I agree with you that it's not that all of these individual TDs are conspiring against these people to try and compound their suffering, of course, yeah, but
it just seems like that.
Stop that from happening if you can at all, or, yeah, you know, be honest about the experience you're having in terms of your department, you know, somehow is it, if it's even possible, forcing you to do something. Yeah, you know,
this is only the warm up, right? Mm. Like, we haven't even got the report yet. And when the report comes out, there will be a requirement on government to act on its findings and if there are recommendations. And like, this is like, people really need to know this. This is only the warm-up stage.
There's 4,000 pages.
Yeah. And, you know, it's going to be the lovely thing about this week, if you want a silver lining, is like how hyper aware the public is on this now. And it won't be easy for any civil servants or anyone else to gloss over that report and its findings, because people know what they're talking about now. And, you know, we know how and where to put the pressure to ensure that government acts. And this decision, you know, this week, like, Alice Murray Higgins was really good on it yesterday, pointing out there were some positives to come out of this. But we can keep applying the pressure to get further changes. Like, hopefully this won't come to the case of a case needing to be taken. Hopefully the government can introduce the necessary amendments to get this done right.
Well, the fact that when Holly asked about amendments the other day, the no that she was given, yeah, was so disrespectful. And that told an awful lot about what was, yeah, going on.
It raises important questions. Oh, sorry.
I was going to say, we actually just need to move on from this. So, Holly, thank you so much. And
thank you
for everything that you have done this week. You were absolutely phenomenal, and it was an absolute joy to watch in terms of somebody really standing up for survivors. You played a blinder, and well done. We are actually, if you want to hang on, we're going to start talking about some of the other bills that were passed this week. Martin, what else happened on Thursday?
Well, they voted against a rent freeze, which is in the middle of rolling lockdowns. And we are in the middle of rolling lockdowns. That's the strategy the government have taken, for better or for worse. They've decided that tenants can be thrown to the wolves. So we're in a situation where you're not allowed to go 5 km from your house, but the sheriff can go with everybody he needs and chuck you out of your house. I understand Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are always going to do this. They are the landlord parties, the developer parties, the builder parties. They're always going to do it. But the Greens, come on, guys, come on. Seriously. Come on. I said during the week, if you're still in the Green Party, it's not because you're green, and it's not because you're green. You're there for some other purpose. What do you think?
There was also the co-living bill as well. So, and that's, again, not really green policy, you know. So, like, I am concerned that the Greens are, well, we know that the Greens are done after this, like the anger that you've seen directed. And you've had members of the Green Party trying to explain away, particularly around the mother and baby homes, but explain away what's been happening, and getting ratioed is the only way I can describe it. Like, it's phenomenal to see the kinds of stuff that has gone on this week. And it's phenomenal to see them rolling over and having their belly tickled yet again when they've gotten into government. And that's the crux of it. Holding feet to the fire has not even been an option. If you think of all of the things since June, all of the things that they've agreed to. And I think they're done. I think, we
spoke to Joe Pino during the weekend. Joe is part of the broad left coalition that's in government in Portugal. Now, we'll be putting the podcast up during the week. But they're actually lifting people out of poverty during their pandemic. We're pushing more people into it. And I see there's quite a few articles have come out during the weekend, what I would call well-heeled people, saying that the only option to take the poor out of poverty is to have them on the front line during a pandemic. That's a very nice view from a very high ivory tower. But I have a much better view, and that's pay them 350 pub like you were paying them. That was actually lifting people out of poverty, and you finance it. You're the guys with the money, so you finance it. And instead of saying the poor must work their way out of poverty, because that's not true, it doesn't happen, simply increase the pub and give them the option to work in poverty or live out of poverty. I don't know why we're entertaining these views. The simple solution is the rich people have the money, and the richest of the rich have the money, and they should be paying for the pandemic cost. It's that simple. There is no two ways about this. The 0.01% tax them more. They are the ones who can afford to pay for this. The least amount of people taxed to do the greatest good. Just do it.
Absolutely. And we had other legislation this week, Vicky, in regards to powers for the Gardaí in relation to the new lockdown. So talk us a little bit through what that's looked like.
Yeah, it's a bit disappointing again. Liam O'Hara is concerned again at the speed at which this was done. But it's also, it's kind of unclear where this is coming from, because the policing authority, of which I'm a member, had indicated that this was not an appropriate strategy to adopt. Fines was, you know, it would be counterproductive to start introducing them. The Garda commissioner himself had said publicly previously that he didn't want to see a state where we were implementing fines. The ICCL had raised concerns about it, and yet it's been done. The medical evidence is weak. I mean, Northern Ireland has had a fine system since March, and that hasn't helped them. And I think one of the concerns is about tone and approach. So, and it's an interesting week to talk about that with the guards, but that the guards, by and large, have done very successful work during COVID. We've seen really improved relationships with in the space of domestic violence and sexual violence, traveller communities reporting much, much better relationships. And that's because they focused on, they have their four E's, and on encouraging people to apply with enforcement as a last resort. And that's been really, really important. The guards have said that that's been really important. Now, they haven't always got that right. And, you know, the policing of protests has been problematic. We see the move this week where there was a very clear and definite, very strong, forceful response to one protest on Grafton Street, or one demonstration on Grafton Street. And it was interesting to see how few turned up yesterday in response to that. But just to be clear, that was using pre-existing public order legislation that had nothing to do with the new legislation that was brought in.
Yeah, it's we'll have to wait and see what's happened. I've been stopped twice at checkpoints this week and asked where I'm going. So, and there is a permanent, I live in Newbridge in Kildare, and there's a permanent checkpoint around the corner. And I know that I've seen checkpoints in other places as well. So
I haven't seen one in Donegal yet. But.
And actually, you've been level four for longer than, so you probably should have seen more. Be interesting to see what happens with that. Vicky, you also wanted to talk a little bit about somebody showing a bit of disrespect to his boss at the moment.
I just, like, where is Seamus Wolfe? You know, where is he?
And Stephen Donnelly.
But seriously, like, how many times, is it three or four times now he's cancelled that meeting? And I think it's really problematic. Like, you know, the Chief Justice has asked for a meeting to discuss his behaviour, and he's cancelled that many times. And, like, fine, maybe he does have health issues. And of course, there may be very legitimate reasons for this. But it all just feels like he's waiting it out for something, you know, to change, or people to forget about it. Or I don't know. It's this process should be possible to engage in this process. It shouldn't be the Chief Justice shouldn't be being kind of pushed around like this, and it shouldn't get forgotten, and people should still have the concerns that they had and question marks over the propriety of one of the most senior judges in the country participating in that event in the way that he did, and showing the disregard that he showed when we saw the transcripts of the interview with the Chief Justice, or with the former justice.
So we have Brian Hayes come raise his head again this week, and Mark, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, Brian did an interview. It was classic. It was really great. Brian did an interview, and he considered his position after it, but then he discovered 200,000 plus reasons why he should stay where he is, you know. Brian seems to have slipped through the net. Again, he's in the private sector. There isn't really that accountability that you have, or that you would hope to have with the public sector. I think hope to have is the right word. He has slipped through the net. Vicky, is there, I just wanted to ask, is there a question, this ties into what we were talking about earlier, is there a question about who gave the advice, the GDPR advice that the government is relying on? Could it have been the former Attorney General?
Yeah, well, I'm not actually clear. I don't know if Holly knows that, which Attorney General, like, at what point was that advice given? I mean, there is the point as well that the government always tends to treat the AG's advice. There's two things tend to happen. Firstly, they treat it like it's binding when it's not. So there is, you know, it's advice. They take it and they make their own decision. Same as NPHET. But then there's also the point that they don't tend to publish the advice that's been given. That's invariably the position. So it's very hard to challenge it or understand the arguments behind it.
Yeah, sorry for taking that on a tangent, Linda. Back to you.
No, you're fine. So is Caroline there? I think she's, yes, she is.
I'm sorry.
Yes, Caroline's in her car now, for those that can see. So all the excitement of Tony's run is over. Caroline, you were going to talk to us a little bit about, we're on Zoom here, you know, and everyone's behaving, cameras are on, nothing bad is happening. Talk to us a little bit about what happened to journalist with The New Yorker, Jeffrey Toobin. He was also had a position of great responsibility with CNN, I believe. What happened to him this week?
This is the problem when you don't understand what Zoom etiquette is or work etiquette. So they were all doing, I suppose, a simulation of the election, and, you know, they're all pretending to be Trump and, you know, doing their general run through. And then they realized at the end, he thought he'd switched into another Zoom call, which is essentially a phone sex call. And he didn't switch in because he was masturbating, and that was caught on the official work call. So that's obviously a massive problem, because no one wants to see anyone else's penis at work unless you've got the kind of work environment where that's a thing. And that's literally like less than 1% of workplaces. One of my sex worker friends had said it's actually ridiculously common for men to masturbate at work. So that's a different conversation as well. But just, I mean, like, you can wait like 5 minutes, you know, just to like really make sure that the Zoom call has ended. You know, it's not a hard thing to do. And I know, like, you know, that's America and he's been suspended now. I kind of think maybe he should have got fired, because I don't want to see someone else's penis in my workspace. So, you know, if they did that in real life, they'd be fired. So I don't see why Zoom is really any different. But so it was over here. You know, the similar thing was that there were college students who were caught having sex during a lecture because they didn't put their Zoom microphone off. So, you know, it's really a case of like, be careful how you're using Zoom and actually the kind of activity you're engaging in when you're meant to be at work or at college. Just wait 5 minutes. Like, your penis can wait. It's okay. It won't fall off.
We've all had that thing. Like, I mean, I know in work I've had that thing where, you know, you might be on quite a long Zoom call and you might need to run to the loo. And we've seen videos of people have that happen to them as well, where they haven't maybe turned their video off too. Thankfully, it hasn't happened to me. But this is a whole other level. Like, I mean, you're supposed to be paying attention. You're in work, for God's sake.
You're not going to take all the information in if you're on a phone sex call and at the same time. Like, you're just not. And, you know, like, some of us are very multi-talented, but not to that degree. So there's quite a few people who are saying, oh, this is sexual harassment, because we're kind of sick of, you know, we can't actually exist in a space without men taking their penises out. We remember the Louis C.K. stuff where he would just masturbate at people at comedy gigs. Harvey Weinstein wasn't that long ago. And, you know, all these kind of things. So sometimes you might think, oh, it's harmless fun. And then, you know, the hashtag Zoom dick was trending and me tubing was trending as well. And you kind of think, oh, it is a bit of a laugh and it is an isolation. But then when you stack it up against all the opportunities, or not opportunities, that's definitely the wrong word there, but all the incidences of people exposing their penises at work, you're like, just put your genitals away. it's not that hard to do. Like,
yeah, if you love somebody, keep your trousers on. You know, it's just, it's no, not that.
We're blessed our thousand women.
Oh, I'm staying real. Look, I don't know. I go with Caroline on this. Wait the 5 minutes, Christ almighty. It's not, you know, you won't die for lack of it.
Do you know what the worst thing was? It was a vote simulation. That's what they were doing. Like, it was a presidential vote simulation.
But maybe, like, that can be a turn on for a lot of people, because you're in a position of power. You're talking about, like, an election that probably once upon a time, America was the most powerful country in the world. Like, power and sex go really hand in hand. But your penis shouldn't be in your hand while you're having these conversations.
Vicky, you wanted to say something.
No, I mean, I thought was interesting, but this obviously takes it to a whole other level. I think you're right there by that point around power and sex, and, you know, like, when you've got one of the candidates known for talking about grabbing pussies, and, like, it's, you know, it is problematic, and there is like, the patriarchy is everywhere in your workplace, as we know. It's just another kind of variety on that.
Actually, I'm going to just address a question that came into the chat there about the mother and baby homes while we're talking about patriarchy. And it was, I just need to look back, DJ, I think. And one of the questions was, you know, do we believe that what's been going on in terms of the mother and baby home, the cervical checks scandal and things like that, is it just that we live in such a patriarchal society that women, you know, trauma that has happened to women in this country is diminished. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's almost swept under the carpet. So any thoughts on that, Caroline, Vicky?
I think that's true. You know, when I did the podcast with Vicky Field, I was like, what do you think the next big scandal is going to be? And she was saying it's the vaginal mesh transplants that are now, you know, we're now recognizing they shouldn't have been in people's bodies at all. But, you know, we don't hear a lot about, you know, male-bodied health issues, you know, being left to that, I suppose. But, you know, although I suppose like male victims of sexual violence are completely erased from a lot of these conversations as well. And we have to remember that. And the industrial schools had their fair share of male victims as well. But it's systematically been women. And, you know, like women aren't taking out their genitals and masturbating at work for the most part. This is men generally doing that to other women. They're not masturbating at work around other men, you know, statistically. So there is, you can't get away from the gender element of it and that power and control narrative as well. And, you know, a lot of these guys who are doing it, you know, listening to my sex worker friends, they're saying, you know, they're ordering to them to go into the toilets at work and masturbate. And like, that's one completely different thing, but it's something about power, work, control, and sex and all those things. There's so much to it. It's not just, oh, he got his dick out on a Zoom call. Like, there's so much more to it than that.
Fully agree. Vicky?
I think it's more than the patriarchy. Like, I think the patriarchy is part of it, but I think this is about living in a post-colonial society and how that has shaped us. And I like, see, Ronan McCord is talking about class as well. It's also about race. It's about, you know, a system that protects certain elites. And, you know, like, I have a real thing that, like, just when we got our own state, we're just, you know, this narrative becomes that the state we create is perfect and it's brilliant and aren't we amazing and well-versed and doing all the right things and helping all the right people. And we can't engage in unpacking that and in acknowledging the harms that we did to ourselves. We can't blame the Brits this time, you know, but we have to acknowledge the harms we've done to ourselves over the last century. And yeah, it's class, it's patriarchy, it's all of it, but it's symptomatic of that. And like, it's interesting because while this is an issue that affected women who were pregnant, of course, so many of the children that were born were also male. Like, you know, there are male victims in this, absolutely. And so it's easy to see this in a more gendered way. But like, this is just so broad. Yeah.
Guys, we will open it up to the Q&A for our patrons. So if you want to become a patron, go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and you could be here next week giving us your thoughts and views. We will leave it there for the normal podcast and thank you very much for listening. Sorry, Vicky.
Hero of the week.
Yeah.
Forgot Hero of the Week. I'm the worst host. This is why they don't let me do it too often. Sorry, apologies. So we started this last week. So everyone is going to nominate their Hero of the Week. So Caroline, do you want to go first?
Yeah, this week was just so hard to pick. I was really overwhelmed with all the news during the week about mother and baby homes. I think absolutely everyone in that was a hero. And of course, our podfather, Tony, is a hero for what he's done this week as well. But I suppose like on a more not personal level, but I, you know, and not a plug for tomorrow's podcast in Glow West, but my Hero of the Week is going to be Diana James, who is on tomorrow's episode. And she is intersex. And just the battle that she's had to get where she's been has just been absolutely horrendous, you know. And she's been a long-term activist, you know, for like 40 odd years and has experienced discrimination in so many different circles. And some of the stories she tells on the podcast are just absolutely, they're absolutely horrific. But to take all that and then to begin training so that she can be an intersex counselor for other intersex people, I just think like the everyday average person who uses all that trauma and turns it into helping others for good, and they're just like aspirational and inspirational and, you know, awe-inspiring isn't even, they're not even good enough words, but I was just blown away by that quiet fight that you see sometimes on the everyday, you know.
Yeah, totally agree. Martin,
I'm going to go with teachers, and I'm going to go with teachers this week. I think teachers have been much maligned over the years. I think we have learned the importance of what they do during the pandemic. They are not childminders, they are educators. And I think they are being thrown to the wolves. They didn't sign up to be frontline workers, and they are now the cutting edge of frontline workers. I know teachers personally who are terrified going into school at the moment, utterly terrified. So I'm with teachers, and I say I'm thinking about you this week. I really am, and I don't know what you're facing back into at the end of this week when you go back to school, but I'm standing right there with you.
And Vicky?
I'm going closer to home. I'm going with Tony. I think, it's so wrong that the state creates a situation where organizations like Anna Liffey and ICHH are needed, and that they have to run on donations and volunteers and all of this. It's so, so wrong. And both to highlight the work that they do, but to raise that money. And we've all know people that have done sponsorship things and you chuck the quid at them. But when you actually think about what this involved, like over 2,000 miles in the last 10 months in Ireland, Irish weather, during a lockdown, like to have the capacity to keep that up. Like nobody would have said boo if he'd turned around in May and said, look, lockdown, I can't do this. It's not going to happen. So I think he's my hero of the week.
And fully agree. So our hero of the week this week is Mr. Tony Groves, podfather to us all, and well deserved. So as I said earlier, we're going to leave it there for the normal podcast this week. Apologies for that. And as I said, you can find us on patreon.com/TortoiseShack if you want to become a patron and to give us your views. Stick around to the patrons who are here. We're going to do our Q&A now. And thank you very much for listening. And well done, Tony, again.
Hi, folks. The recording was stopped at that stage, and Martin sent me on the file, so I'm putting it together. I do want to take this opportunity, though, to add my little 2 cents, just to say to so many people who've supported the run, the challenge, the Run 2020, a sincere and heartfelt thank you. It's been an immense challenge for me personally, and it means so much that so many people have supported. If you're clicking donate anywhere on the Tortoise Shack for the next week, that money is going to Inner City Helping Homeless and Anna Liffey. We really appreciate it. It's look, tortoiseshack.ie/run2020. But again, I can't say enough about the great people who the work that they do, and to be able to chip in and raise awareness has been, it's been amazing. Thanks so much. Talk to you all soon. Bye bye.